From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
In the same document, Mr. Cooney deleted the phrase, quote, climate change has global consequences for human health and the environment, end quote. Is there anything scientifically questionable about this phrase?
Again, no.
Scientists claim the Bush administration tampered with and suppressed their research to downplay the threat of global warming. Then the battle for the world's vanishing oil resources.
90% of the scientists of the UN panel on climate change say that emissions created by human activity are the main cause of global warming. But will President Bush, the ostrich, raise his head from the sand and listen?
Author DeLapiro on Blood of the Earth. And the Housing Authority of New Orleans is asking an attorney for low-income residents to stop making statements to the media. This is Housing Activists Today Get Arrested in New Orleans. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Anti-war momentum gathered steam on Capitol Hill Tuesday with new resolutions and testimony challenging the Bush administration's plans for Iraq. Appearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, former Bush administration counsel Bradford Berenson said the Constitution gives Congress broad authority to end war. Three other constitutional experts gave backing testimony. Republican Senator Arlen Specter challenged President Bush's recent vow to send more troops to Iraq regardless of what happens in Congress.
I would suggest respectfully to the president that he is not the sole decider, that the decider is a shared and joint responsibility.
The Senate is expected to take up a non-binding resolution against the White House's handling of the Iraq war later today. Meanwhile, Senator Russ Feingold said he'll introduce a measure barring funding for the war over a six-month period.
This hearing has shown that this legislation is fully consistent with the Constitution of the United States. Congress should enact it, and soon the hearing is adjourned.
Other measures continue to arise. On Tuesday, Democratic Senator Barack Obama introduced a bill calling for the withdrawal of all U.S. troops by April of next year. Meanwhile, Congressmember John Murtha announced plans to hold hearings on the use of military contractors in Iraq.
But we're going to have extensive hearings to find out exactly what's going on with contractors. I hear estimates of 100,000, but the worst thing is we don't know. They don't have a clear mission, and they're falling all over each other.
Capitol Hill was also the site of more protests. Activists with the group Code Pink occupied the office of New York Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, calling on the presidential hopeful to oppose the Iraq war. One banner said, quote, "We want a woman for peace, not just a woman." Six people were arrested. In news from Iraq, there are new doubts about the U.S. and Iraqi claim hundreds of people killed in a battle in Najaf were members of a messianic cult. London Independent correspondent Patrick Coburn reports the official story could actually be covering up for a massacre. The Iraqi government says it battled members of the Soldiers of Heaven who were planning to disrupt the Shia Holy Festival of Ashura. But independent reports indicate the fighting actually centered around an entirely different tribe called the Hawatim. According to these accounts, the Hawatim were on their way to the celebrations in Najaf when Iraqi soldiers opened fire, killing their chief, his wife, and their driver. The tribesmen are said to have responded by attacking the Iraqi military checkpoint. Two U.S. soldiers died after their helicopter was struck as it backed the Iraqi forces. The new account has not been verified, as Iraqi authorities have barred reporters from speaking to survivors. In Germany, prosecutors have issued arrest warrants for 13 U.S. operatives linked to the kidnapping and torture of the German citizen Khaled al-Masri. Masri was seized along the Serbian-Macedonian border and flown to Afghanistan, where he was tortured inside a secret prison. He was released without charge after 5 months. Masri tried to sue the CIA in federal court, but his case was dismissed on grounds a trial could harm national security. The news comes as an Italian court is considering whether to try two dozen U.S. agents over the kidnapping of the Egyptian cleric Abu Omar. In Cuba, new video has appeared of Fidel Castro for the first time in 3 months. Castro is seen meeting with Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez Monday. Castro temporarily stepped down last July to recover from an unspecified intestinal condition and surgery. Back in Washington, Chavez has come under new criticism from National Intelligence Director John Negroponte. On Tuesday, Negroponte said Chavez is a threat to democracy who exports, quote, radical populism. Negroponte was speaking before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which is considering his nomination to become Deputy Secretary of State. The Bush administration's facing new accusations of suppressing information about global warming. On Tuesday, NASA climatologist Drew Schindel told the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee his reports on climate change were delayed, edited, and watered down by White House appointees who were said to have vetted all climate-related material. We'll have more on this story after headlines. In other environmental news, Greenpeace is calling for a higher reduction of carbon dioxide emissions than mandated under the Kyoto Protocol. On Tuesday, Greenpeace released a report calling for a reduction of nearly 50% of the next half century. Climate and energy policy advisor Steve Sawyer warned of drastic consequences if the world's temperature rises by even a few degrees.
My country, where I live in Holland, will effectively disappear. The World Trade Center Memorial will be underwater, and the coastlines of the continents as we know them will have completely changed beyond all recognition, and we'll be looking at hundreds and hundreds of millions of people with no place to live.
The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is planning to release a report Friday saying there's at least a 90% chance human activities are the main cause of climate change. The same scientists listed a 66% probability 6 years ago. In domestic surveillance news, the FBI appears to have adopted an invasive internet surveillance technique that collects far more data on innocent Americans than previously disclosed. CNET News reports, instead of recording only what a particular suspect is doing, agents conducting investigations appear to be assembling data on thousands of internet users at a time into massive databases. Those databases can then be mined for names, email addresses, or keywords. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. A federal appeals court has reinstated a key charge in the government's terrorism case against Jose Padilla. On Tuesday, the court overturned an earlier ruling that he was facing extra punishment for being charged more than once over the same act. The reinstated charge is the only one that can sentence him to life in prison. Padilla was initially accused of being an enemy combatant, but he's now being held on less serious charges. Back in Washington, former New York Times reporter Judith Miller testified Tuesday in the perjury and obstruction trial of Vice President Dick Cheney's former chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby. Miller became the sixth witness to reveal Libby talked about former CIA operative Valerie Plame earlier than he's claimed. Miller spent nearly 3 months in jail in 2005 for refusing to reveal her confidential source in her coverage of the case. The source turned out to be Libby. In Florida, police in Tampa are facing a major controversy for jailing a female college student after she reported she was raped. The unidentified woman was kept behind bars for 2 days. She was also denied a second dose of the morning after contraceptive pill because of prison workers' religious beliefs. Police say they made the arrest after discovering a 4-year-old warrant stemming from a burglary arrest when the woman was a juvenile. The warrant was discovered as police were accompanying the woman to the crime scene. They immediately stopped the investigation and put her in handcuffs. And finally, a federal jury has ruled police in Seattle violated the constitutional rights of nearly 200 protesters during the 1999 protests against the World Trade Organization. The protesters were arrested after gathering at a public park. The jury ruled the police violated the protesters' Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable search and seizure. City officials say they plan to appeal. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration was accused Tuesday of misleading the public over the threat of global warming and of interfering with the work of government scientists studying climate change. According to a new survey, hundreds of government scientists said they've perceived or personally experienced pressure to eliminate phrases such as climate change and global warming from their reports and public statements. One-third of the scientists surveyed also said officials at their agencies have made statements on climate change that misrepresented their findings. One of those scientists, NASA climatologist Drew Schindel, testified Tuesday before the Committee on House Oversight and Government Reform. Dr. Schindel has worked as a researcher at NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies since 1995.
Provide information to policymakers and the public on issues affecting society. Climate change is clearly such an issue, and one for which it is especially critical that decisions be made using the best available scientific information, as the potential cost to society of action or of inaction are large. The Earth as a whole is unquestionably warming, and virtually all climate scientists believe that the evidence regarding a human role in this warming is clear and compelling. Multiple lines of evidence based on measurements, theory, and modeling support these conclusions. The scientific evidence indicates that the Earth is now warmer than at any time during the last 1,000 years. While continued warming is inevitable, the seriousness of the consequences of climate change will depend upon societal action to limit the emissions of greenhouse gases and pollutants that are the dominant cause of global warming. These consequences include droughts and flood, increased severity of summer heat waves, and rises in sea level that could devastate low-lying coastal areas. Although the scientific basis for the conclusion that human activities are altering Earth's climate is extremely strong, their questions are still raised over whether current scientific understanding justifies societal action. One of these arguments has concerned Antarctic temperature trends. While most of the planet has warmed rapidly during the past several decades, much of the Antarctic continent has, by contrast, cooled. Lack of an adequate explanation for this has been cited as evidence that scientific understanding of climate change is simply too incomplete to warrant taking action to mitigate global warming. In the fall of 2004, a team I led at NASA published a paper providing an explanation of how ozone depletion over Antarctica and increasing greenhouse gases could together account for this observed cooling of Antarctica. The study was the first to look at how these two factors work together to influence Antarctic temperatures. It not only helped to explain the observed cooling, but also predicted a warmer future for Antarctica based on projections of continued increases in greenhouse gases. This has clear implications both for the debate on global warming and for potential sea level rise, as Antarctica contains an enormous reservoir of water in its ice sheets. The NASA press corps and I wrote a press release on these findings to convey them to the broader public. While previous to this time, press releases had been issued rapidly and with reservations from headquarters that basically were made to improve clarity and style, this release was repeatedly delayed, altered, and eventually watered down. When we at GISS inquired of those higher up the NASA chain what was going on, we were told in the fall of 2000 releases were being delayed because two political appointees and the White House were now reviewing all climate-related press releases. Scientists do not simply explore what we are most curious about. We know that our research is funded by the public, and we go to great lengths to provide policy-relevant information to support decision-making. While it was frustrating for me to see my work suppressed, even more importantly, it's a disservice to the public to distort or suppress information needed. But that experience is only one example of a series of actions that attempted to suppress communication of climate science to the public. Also during the fall of 2004, NASA headquarters insisted that a NASA press officer be present to monitor all interviews, either in person or on the phone, a measure most of us felt was unbefitting of a democratic society. As with the interference with press releases, the restrictions were not imposed on other parts of NASA, such as space science, or even other areas of Earth science outside of climate research.
NASA climatologist Drew Shandell testifying Tuesday before the Committee on House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. The committee's chair, Henry Waxman, later questioned Shandell about how the Bush administration's altered scientific reports to downplay the threat of global warming.
Many experts are telling us that global warming is one of the most severe environmental threats facing this nation and the world, that challenges confronting us are enormous, potentially. And therefore, I think policymakers have an obligation to understand the science, and we need to get that scientific information without any manipulation of the science, without any suppressing of the reports or misleading the public about the issues, seems to me would be a breach of the public trust. So we have been asking for this information. Dr. Shandell, you're one of the nation's leading climate change scientists, and I want to discuss some of the documents that the committee staff reviewed and ask whether you are concerned about the issues in these documents. First of all, Let me begin by asking about some of the edits urged by the White House Office of Management and Budget. OMB asked that an EPA report be rewritten to remove the statement that global warming may, quote, alter regional patterns of climate, end quote, and, quote, potentially affect the balance of radiation, end quote. Dr. Sindel, do you think this was an appropriate change in the document? The statement in the EPA draft was that climate change can alter regional climates and affect the balance of radiation. Is there any scientific justification for removing these assertions?
No, that is a very well-supported statement. For the changing the energy balance of the planet, we have satellite data that have measured that balance directly for decades now, and we can see it changing. It is extremely well-documented and uncontroversial. Regional patterns, I mentioned before, yes. Antarctica has gone the other way from the rest of the globe. Different areas have warmed more, others less. It's quite clear that this is happening.
Another edit deleted the phrase, quote, changes observed over the last several decades are likely mostly the result of human activities, end quote. And that phrase was replaced with the phrase that said, quote, a causal link between the buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and the observed climate changes during the 20th century cannot be unequivocally established, end quote. Is this an appropriate change? Does the rephrasing accurately represent the science, or does it mislead the public?
I would say that that is also a misleading statement. While technically true, the first statement that human activities play the dominant role is much more accurate picture of the science.
Some of the edits we reviewed were made by CEQ Chief of Staff Philip Cooney. Now, Mr. Cooney is not a scientist by training. Instead, he's a lawyer who was working as a lobbyist for the American Petroleum Institute before he was appointed to his position at the Council on Environmental Quality. And I'd like to ask you some questions about his edits. In one document, Mr. Cooney deleted a reference to the National Research Council's finding that human activities are causing temperatures to rise. Obviously, the National Research Council is this country's premier scientific body. Can you tell us if there is a scientific basis for deleting a reference to this finding?
No, that is, again, a well-supported statement.
In the same document, Mr. Cooney deleted the phrase, quote, climate change has global consequences for human health and the environment, end quote. Is there anything scientifically questionable about this phrase?
Again, no.
And yet another edit, Mr. Cooney wrote that satellite data disputes global warming. Is this scientifically valid?
No. There was for many years a controversy where satellite data showed warming, but to a different degree than was seen at the surface or that was predicted by models higher up in the atmosphere. It never disputed global warming, and that controversy has since been resolved.
If climate changes offer us an incredibly serious problem, then we need to get the facts and rely on federal scientists and agencies to give Congress and the public the true facts about this global threat. Yet the preliminary evidence we're seeing from the White House suggests that the administration may have taken a very different approach. If the documents we have seen so far are representative, it appears that the White House installed a former oil industry lobbyist as the chief of staff for the Council on Environmental Quality, and then systematically sought to prevent the Environmental Protection Agency from reporting on dangers to health, the environment, and the economy. In effect, it appears that there may have been an orchestrated effort to mislead the public about the threat of global climate change. These are serious allegations, and they are ones that we'll be exploring in detail in this hearing and in our ongoing investigation.
Congressmember Henry Waxman questioning NASA climatologist Drew Sindel. When we come back, Dilip Hero on Blood of the Earth, the battle for the world's vanishing oil resources. Stay with us. Whoa. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blues
skies go. Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Oh, mercy, mercy me, mercy. All things and what they used to be lost are oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas. Fish full of mercury. Underground and in the sky, animals and birds who live nearby are alive. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more we use from man? Can't you stand?
Mercy, mercy me. Marvin Gaye here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As scientists in Paris finalized their report on the adverse effects of human-caused emissions on climate change, a new book offers a detailed account of how and why the planet's limited supply of oil has come to revolutionize human behavior, politics, and warfare across the globe. It's called Blood of the Earth, The Battle for the World's Vanishing Oil Resources, a detailed account of the history of oil. It reveals when states replace coal with oil, they scramble to meet an unprecedented global energy demand. The book details how states have attempted to meet that growing thirst for oil through economic expansion and all-out war. It also explores developments in alternatives or renewable sources of energy. We're joined now by the book's author, Dilip Piro, veteran journalist in the Middle East. His trilogy of books on Iraq and Iran are considered some of the most definitive histories of the wars in the Persian Gulf. Welcome to Democracy Now! How did oil become so central, Dilip Piro?
I think oil became important when internal combustion engine was fueled by petroleum. See, in 1905 that happened. Before that, you could fuel internal combustion engine with electricity or with steam. You know, but when oil proved to be the most important, and then 1905, Henry Ford, his mass production of cars, and that really made the whole thing go up. And in terms of warfare, it was during World War I that in the tank, internal combustion engine was fueled by petroleum products, and that made the whole technology, strategy of war change in the way, like the first finding of gunpowder in 1041. Because, see, as a general, you could now, see, before that they had to depend on horses, cavalry, and the horses had to be fed, they had to rest and so on, but once you had a tank, you could go 30, 40 miles in a day, and that changed the whole way the war was fought. So oil is very important.
You begin your book with the Nobel brothers. The Nobel brothers, who introduced the first oil-fueled steamship.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, of course, there is a great book by Daniel Yergin called The Prize. You know, I'm afraid he goes on and says, in 1859, in Titsville, Pennsylvania, oil was first drilled properly. I'm sorry, he's wrong. It first happened near Baku in 1846. And there was a Russian engineer, he did that. And not in everything that we know about oil happened there first. It was the first in the Caspian, they changed from coal to oil. It was the first time in that part of the world they set up oil pipeline made of wood. It was the first time they had a tanker, oil tanker. So all of that actually originally comes from Azerbaijan and Baku, and of course you mentioned Nobel brothers, and of course, Rothschilds. They made their money there as well. So I think the oil has been so important. But what I have done in my book, I point out there were some local Azeris who became very rich. One of them was totally illiterate, but he had a most wonderful library, and he built something like 135 buildings. So I think the oil has been very powerful and a mineral.
Can you talk about the history of countries nationalizing oil?
Absolutely. You see, initially, of course, America was very much ahead in terms of extraction. You know, they were competing with Azerbaijan, but by the turn of the century, America took off because much bigger and more energy was put into it. At that time, countries in the Persian Gulf area, you know, like Saudi Arabia or Kuwait, et cetera, they did not have a technology. And so they were courting foreign companies, especially British companies, to come and find oil, you know. And in the whole region, it was the British company, Anglo-Persian Oil Company, which got a contract, except where? In Saudi Arabia. In 1933, the Saudi king gave concession to the Standard Oil Company of California. And from that day onwards, as we speak now, the nexus between Saudi Arabia and Washington, D.C. is so tight that despite the fact that 15 out of 19 hijackers are Saudi citizens, nothing changed. 2 days after 9/11, George W. Bush was smoking his cigars along with the Saudi ambassador, Prince Bandar. As you know, he's called not Prince Bandar, he's called Bandar Bush. So you see, that oil is absolutely and definitely important in shaping diplomacy. In terms of oil nationalization, it only came after 1973 Arab-Israeli war, because then oil price went up and those countries had more money, and so they bought up the foreign companies, Western companies.
Let's continue on the theme of Saudi Arabia and Washington, which you document well, and you take us to Texas as well, and you particularly talk about the intermingling of the Saudi royal family and the Bush family in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, see, some of the things that I found, you know, they are actually something which can give you sleepless nights, honestly. In the USA, I'm talking overland, I'm not talking offshore oil. In the USA, there are 500,000 oil wells, and their output is about 5 million. On an average, the U.S. Oil well produces 10 barrels a day. And I have been to Qatar, I have been to Kuwait. In that part of the world, oil well produces 2,500 barrels a day, 250 times more. Now, if you go to Qatar or and Kuwait and say, "Have you seen a donkey pump?" They say, "What? I mean, we don't have donkeys here." This pump which goes up and down, which you can see all over Texas, California, they don't exist in Persian Gulf area. Why? Because the pressure, natural pressure, is so high that you don't have to pump it out. You know, and that explains so much. Another figure, in 1935, the USA produced 64% of world oil. Last year, they produced 8%. That means oil has been used up. And remember Richard Nixon, 1973, he was the first one. Oil independence. We will be free of oil import by 1979. And Jerry Ford came in. He said, "No, we're free in 1985. Jimmy Carter came in. He said, 1990. And then we have George W. Bush. Last year, he woke up and he said, American addiction to oil is undesirable. And then, you know what happened? Last State of the Union speech, he said, we are going to give 22% more money, federal money, for research into alternative fuels. And next day, the New York Times reported that the National Renewable Laboratory is sacking people.
Renewable Energy Laboratory.
Including researchers on wind and ethanol. They were being sacked. So you see, everything that comes from the White House, you should really take it with a huge pinch of salt.
But I want to stay in Texas right now, and how central Texas is to oil, and how central the Bush and Saudi, or how connected the Bush and Saudi family are around this issue.
Absolutely. You know, as I see, that part of the USA has 25% of oil reserves. And, you know, by World War II, Texas became extremely important. As you know, they were giving, federal government was giving concessions to drillers, and you know, they could write off their investment very quickly and so on. And actually, you know, there is a nexus within America between oil and power. I mean, David Rockefeller, he was the most important kerosene exporter. And of course, as you know, the antitrust law came in because of his monopoly on oil. So the oil runs through, you know, history of the USA. And so there's a nexus between big oil and the U.S. government. And even Franklin D. Roosevelt tried to save, you know, the interests of the oil companies and so on, and going back to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia was very much in need of money because it's a very poor country, and during World War II, very few people were going there for pilgrimage from where they used to get money. And so there was a Land Lease Act, 1941, during World War II, and that could only be given to the countries which were fighting for democracy against dictatorship. So Franklin D. Roosevelt, he wanted to help the Saudi king, but what could he do? He said, Land Lease Act is for Democrats, but this man is a dictator. So how can we help him? And somebody came up with the idea that Roosevelt should say that the defense of Saudi Arabia is essential to the defense of the United States, 1943, and that hasn't changed. Again, it's oil. Why it happened during that time? Because when the USA joined the Allies in World War II after December 1941, they supplied 80% of oil to the Allies. And therefore, they were pumping too much oil in the USA, and that concerned the officials, and they say we should look outside, and Saudi Arabia was the one where they saw the possibility after World War II.
President Bush Sr. Moved to Midland, Texas. Then George W. Bush also lived in Midland, Texas. What about the bailing out of the Bushes by the Saudi family?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, Midland is the administrative and financial center of oil in Texas. Okay, and of course, at least one has to say Bush Sr. was a successful oil man. You know, he drilled 128 wells, and all of them were good. They gave, you know, I mean, it's wonderful. So he made his first $1 million there, then he moved to Houston. And so you see the conjunction of oil and politics is, you know, it's interlinked. And then you take Houston. Houston is the international center of oil. And that's where the Saudis and the Kuwaitis, they put their money, you know, buying up stocks and shares and so on, and property, et cetera, et cetera. And because they said, we will put money behind a company which has political muscle. And anything with Bush, or anything with Carlucci, who was the defense secretary under
Frank Carlucci
under Reagan, and then, you know, this. And so that's where the money went in. And if you look at the...
And didn't Carlucci also become head of the Carlyle Group?
Yeah, of course, you know, they set up their own the Carlyle Group. You know, and a lot of the money has come from there. So there is this kind of a conjunction there. Now, specifically about the failed oil man, otherwise known as George Walker Bush, his company was going down the drain. And lo and behold, his company got a contract from the ruler of Bahrain to do offshore drilling when his company had never drilled a single hole offshore. And that is when he got his leg up and, you know, and became, in quote, a successful oil man. So I think, you know, as I'm giving all the illustrations to show the, you know, nexus of oil within the USA and that particular connection going into the Persian Gulf area, Saudis, Kuwaitis, United Arab Emirates, and that is not going to change.
You talk about the role of oil in the current war in Iraq and the occupation, De La Pira.
Yeah, I think there's a few. I mean, from page 133 to 148, I've got 15 pages of evidence that oil was an important factor for invading Iraq. You know, and there is a and one of the piece of evidence I point out, BBC television, Newsnight program, aired a special feature on oil in March 2005. And they got some of the papers in the USA, Freedom of Information Act. Now, a very important man, Iraqi-American oil consultant called Falah al-Jaburi. And he said within weeks of George W. Bush entering the White House, they made plans to take over Iraqi oil company. I mean, according to him. And Mr. Jaburi had a long track during the days of Ronnie Reagan. He was a back channel between Ronnie Reagan and Saddam Hussein, Iran-Iraq war. So, you know, so he points out that this particular plan went ahead. Two plans came up. One was the State Department plan, that once we overthrow Saddam Hussein, then American money will go into the oil industry, will push up the output. There was a secret Pentagon plan that we will take our oil and privatize it and give it away to foreign companies. You know, and of course, remember, after Saddam Hussein's statue came down, April 9, 2003, all the ministries were allowed to be burned down. You know, mobs came out, they burned all the ministries, all the public buildings, except oil. You know, all the Pentagon soldiers are surrounding it because oil was they wanted to keep, you see. Now, you might say, why has this privatization not happened? I'll tell you three reasons. One is that they found out that the Geneva Convention on War says that occupying country power should not change structure, fundamentally change the economy of the occupied country. And, you know, and privatizing oil would have been, you know, beyond the pale. Secondly, the most important leader in Iraq, Grand Ali Sistani, Ayatollah Ali Sistani, said oil is the property of the nation. And so they could not go against him. And thirdly, more importantly, as soon as the word is spread, the Americans are going to privatize oil. You know, the oil employees started to blow up. Oil employees, the pipelines, they stole the pumps and so on and so forth, so that you had two acts of sabotage every week. And that's where Bremer, who was the American proconsul, he, you know, sat back and do it. And now it's too late. Why? New Iraqi Constitution, Article 109, says hydrocarbons are the national property. So they can't actually now, you know, change that. Within that, they can, you know, give concessions, but it will remain in the public sector.
James Baker, his report, the so-called Baker-Hamilton report, recommended, and this was not one of the recommendations that was highlighted by the corporate media in the United States, the privatization of Iraq's oil.
Yeah, I think, privatization can happen this way. Iran and Kuwait, they do this. What you do is that, you know, of course, it's the public sector. It belongs to the, you know, government or government-owned oil company. But you don't. When you give contracts, in the old days, when you give contracts, the foreign company owned the whole area. Yeah, they owned the whole land, 1,000 square miles or whatever. But what they do now, say even in Iran, they do that. They give it to a foreign country company, and they say, listen, you put your money into this, invest some money, et cetera, et cetera. When oil comes out, we'll pay you in oil. And that's called a production sharing agreement. And that is the kind of a thing which will happen in Iraq, because I can assure you, I mean, anything to do with America, American company, American citizens, or even surrogates, if they try to do anything on oil, they will be attacked.
De La Pira, very briefly, if you can talk about the centrality of oil in China and India.
Absolutely. You see, India and China are not just two nations. They are mega nations. Between the two of them, they have 40% of world population. Two out of five human beings are Indians or Chinese. Now, in China,
two out of five
human beings are either Indian or Chinese. Yeah. I mean, you know, so it's not simply two nations. You know, it's 2.4 billion people. Last year, China's oil consumption went up by 15%. That means they're doubling the oil consumption every 5 years, quadrupling it every 10 years. And, you know, India, of course, 8%. And what kind of a potential exists? I'll give you a very quick figure. In the USA, there are 800 vehicles, you know, passenger cars, buses, and minivans, et cetera, for 1,000 American men, women, and children. In India, there are 8 vehicles per 1,000 Indians, men, women, and children. Now, suppose India progresses economically, and you change that figure from 8 to 18 or 80, can you imagine how much oil will be required? And that is something, which one has to face up to. And as I show, there's a, oil, any mineral, you have a bell curve. And the peak will reach in 10 years' time, and then it will start to go down. And at that time, India and China's demand will rise. So what will happen? The price of oil will go up to, take a deep breath, $200 a barrel. And you see, the only other way, if you don't want to have a sleepless night, what you have to say is this. The internal combustion engine can be fueled by natural gas, by hydrogen cells, and by solar panels. And that's already happening. Toyota actually has hundreds of cars running on hydrogen cells. They have a supply system in Tokyo, and I would say in 10 to 15 years' time, a high proportion of cars will be run by fuel other than petroleum product. And that is the only way we can actually save ourselves from a catastrophe which will come if we go on the present path.
De Lapiro, I want to thank you very much for being with us. His book is called Blood of the Earth, The Battle for the World's Vanishing Oil Resources. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, New Orleans. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Shall Not Be Moved, Dirty Dozen Brass Band of New Orleans, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. New Orleans police raided the St. Bernard housing project this morning, where activists had been occupying a building to prevent government plans to demolish it. Two people were arrested. Last summer, federal housing officials announced plans to demolish four large public housing developments, even though tens of thousands of low-income New Orleans residents remain displaced. The move sparked one of the most intense struggles in New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Before the program, we received a call from one of the two people arrested this morning. Bork Laufner spoke with us from the Orleans Parish Prison. She described what happened.
Last night at 2:30 in the morning, Mayday Nolo, which had been in the middle of a 17-day occupation of the New Day Community Center with permission of the leaseholders, had been raided by SWAT team members at gunpoint. It was quite scary. We were there because we believed in the fact that people who lived in these public homes, St. Bernard Project and C.J. Pete and the others, deserve to come back. There's thousands of families that have been displaced, almost 5,000 units that are scheduled for demolishment, and we believe firmly that they shouldn't be demolished, that people should be allowed to return home to New Orleans, to their communities. We believe that these are internally displaced people here in the United States and that everything should be done to get them home. The public housing development is in good shape. It was solid concrete walls. Even though it was flooded, it was architecturally sound, according to MIT architects. And there's no reason for Hanno to decide to hassle people who were just trying to reopen public housing and even have them arrested when they should be concentrating on getting housing back for families that need it.
Jamie Bork-Lochner, speaking from the Orleans Parish Prison. She was arrested this morning. Well, the battle over the future of public housing in New Orleans recently took an unexpected turn. A few days ago, the Housing Authority of New Orleans sent a letter to one of the lead lawyers for the residents, asking him to stop speaking to the media and to remove statements he made that appeared on several online videos. The letter accused Attorney Bill Quigley of making, quote, prejudicial, extrajudicial statements to the press and others. The New Orleans Housing Authority also threatened to haul Quigley in front of the state's Bar Association's disciplinary board if he doesn't agree to stop discussing the case. Bill Quigley joins us now from New Orleans, a law professor at Loyola University. We invited the New Orleans Housing Authority on the program. They didn't respond to our request. Bill Quigley, what is happening in New Orleans?
Well, thank you for helping explain what's going on in New Orleans, but we are really engaged in a fight for the soul and spirit of our community. The public housing struggle is part of the overall struggle in the city to see that there is room in the new New Orleans for renters, for working class people, for the elderly, and for the disabled. We have a significant racial overtones to who is being excluded from the city, and very significant economic overtones in terms of who is being excluded from the city. And the public housing struggle is about 4,500 affordable apartments that the federal government, HUD, is trying to demolish to make way for many fewer apartments that would be pitched to a different audience altogether. The people in charge in the federal government, in cooperation with some private developers in the areas, have actually seen Katrina as an opportunity to get rid of the lowest income people in the community and to, in a sense, start over without the participation of people who used to live here, who could go back into their apartments on very short notice. And that the raid this morning and the charges that have been filed against residents who went back in to clean their own homes, the threats against myself and Tracy Washington, the civil rights lawyers who are working with the residents, just shows that this is really a pitched battle for who gets to come back to New Orleans and who is going to participate in the rebuilding.
We're talking to Bill Quigley at PBS station WLAE in New Orleans. You've got a piece that's on Counterpunch right now online. Why is HUD using tens of millions in Katrina money to bulldoze 4,534 public housing apartments in New Orleans when it costs less to repair and open them up? Well, what is the city saying? What is, do you have the support of, for example, New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin?
No, we really don't. The residents have the support of very few elected officials. Most elected officials are remaining silent. They're not coming out in favor of the demolition, but they're also not opposing it. There's a real transition going on in New Orleans over and a struggle over who's going to be in charge. Is it going to be the white business community who is going to be politically and in every other way in charge of the community, or is it going to be the majority of the city who were its citizens pre-Katrina, where the city was over two-thirds African-American and over half renters and mostly working-class people? The white power structure, assisted in many cases by black professional workers, are in the process of trying to claim the city and claim a new vision for the city that does not include the people who used to live here. And the tragedy is that they are using the money that Congress gave to the victims of Katrina. And they are what I call like Robin Hood in reverse. They are stealing the money that should be coming to the low-income community and instead converting that money and using it for property owners and the developers and the like. And in case of public housing, they're using Katrina tax credits. They're using Katrina rebuilding money in excess of $100 million and additional money to destroy houses that are structurally sound and are actually in better physical physical shape than almost any of the residential buildings in the city of New Orleans. So they are using money to help Katrina. It was designated to help Katrina victims to destroy affordable housing, put money into the pockets of developers, and then put up some other housing that they're not going to let low-income people back into.
So where are these people if they're not allowed back home?
Some are in the suburbs or around New Orleans in a Section 8 house of that, but most of the people are actually still very far away from New Orleans, in Houston and San Antonio and Memphis and Birmingham, Atlanta, and that, and really do not have the ability to come back unless there is affordable housing available. Our rents in the city of New Orleans have gone up 70% in the city, 80% in the suburbs, because we still have tens of thousands of properties that are destroyed and demolished. And the city is undergoing an overall privatization. They are privatizing the public education system. They are privatizing public housing. They are privatizing public health care, and they are privatizing the public employees' workforce. So the public housing is really the most visible symbol of the attack on the poor, the attack on African Americans, attack on the elderly, the disabled, renters, and people who the powers that be in Washington, in Baton Rouge, and in New Orleans would just as soon never come back.
What are you going to do about this demand that you be quiet, that you remove the video from the website that includes your comments? AP did a story in this, quoting Michael Gerhardt, a constitutional law scholar at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, saying, to bypass the judge is unusual, to make the threats is even more unusual.
Yeah, I have been involved in a lot of controversial exchanges and struggles with governmental agencies in the past, but this is really to have the federal government and the local government say, stop talking to the press, insist that interviews on documentaries be taken down and the like, is just, it's very troubling. I have told them I'm not going to do it. I said, you know, no lawyer looks forward to anybody's attempt to yank their license or a gag order from the court, but I said, well, we're not going to do it. This is a fight that the residents and the residents' advocates, the civil rights lawyers, are involved in, that goes on in Congress, goes on in the state legislature, city council, and every place. It's not like some private divorce case where you want both sides to be quiet and just handle it in court. This is an issue of public policy. It's an issue of the direction of our country. It's an issue of economic justice, and is actually, as the person who spoke to you from jail said, it is a matter of international concern. These are internally displaced people that the United Nations Human Rights Council has said have been mistreated on the basis of race and their economic status. So we're not going to be quiet. The residents are not going to stop fighting.
Bill Quigley, just 30 seconds, then we have to move on. But 16 protesters were given prison terms this week. This is on an entirely different issue, but you're the connection between them, an attorney for the School of the Americas protesters, given prison terms ranging from 1 to 6 months during the annual demonstration. They were charged with trespassing.
Yes, people ages 17 to 70 went to federal court in Georgia earlier this week, and I was with them, gave beautiful testimony about their connections and solidarity with the people of Latin America who have been abused, killed, massacred by graduates of the School of the Americas, now called WINSEC, that's on the grounds of Fort Benning. So that's part of an ongoing struggle where over 200 people have spent 92 years in prison standing up in solidarity with our sisters and brothers in Latin America. So people should take a look at the SOAW.org website, and they can find some more about it.
Bill Quigley, thanks so much for joining us, law professor at Loyola University in New Orleans. And a shout-out to our
friends at
the PBS station WLAE, where he is. As we move to our last segment now, the FBI appearing to have adopted an invasive internet surveillance technique that collects far more data on innocent Americans than previously has been disclosed. CNET News reports, instead of recording only what a particular suspect is doing. Agents conducting investigations appear to be assembling data on thousands of internet users at a time into massive databases. Those databases can then be mined for names, email addresses, or keywords. Declan McCullough is with us now, chief political correspondent for CNET News, joining us on the phone from San Francisco. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Well, hi there. Good morning.
Tell us what you know.
Sure. The technique we're talking about surfaced at a discussion at the Stanford Law School, where a former Department of Justice computer crime attorney, and now at the University of Colorado at Boulder Law School, and a current Department of Justice computer crime attorney, the assistant deputy chief, discussed the Fourth Amendment implications of this, and details are still fuzzy, but it seems as though when the FBI gets a court order, gives it to an internet service provider, and says we want all the information that's flowing through a certain person's network or is related to a certain person, and the ISP is incapable of really narrowing it down, the ISP may in some cases say, we can't technically narrow it down, so here's everything from maybe an entire neighborhood or small town. Here it is on some sort of fixed media, like a DVD or magnetic tape, and then the FBI subsequently can do queries against that database. And so that's what we know so far. Unfortunately, the Department of Justice isn't answering questions about that. They sent us a statement saying that sometimes they perform real-time filtering on large data connections carrying the traffic of multiple unrelated facilities, but they have refused so far to answer questions or to put someone on the phone.
How does this relate to carnivore? And explain what this is. We only have a few minutes.
Sure. Carnivore was a box that the FBI would put, hopefully with a court order, on an ISP's network, and then that box would capture only what a specific person was doing. This technique, if it is as we understand it to be, instead is capturing information on maybe hundreds or thousands of people, and then is subsequently narrowed and searched against by the FBI. And so instead of doing it in real time, as we understand a wiretap, they're sort of doing it later, perhaps even over a period of months.
And how can people protect themselves?
You protect yourself by using encryption. You protect yourself by using a service like Anonymizer.com or TOR, which is something that the Electronic Frontier Foundation out here in San Francisco has worked on. So you basically use technology to encrypt your communications instead of relying on the law to do it for you.
I want to thank you, Declan McCullough. Finally, CNET, what are you doing about this?
What are we doing at CNET? Well, we're following it, but we also maintain sort of good internet hygiene and try to encrypt our communications whenever we can, and also use encryption on our laptops.
Declan, thanks for being with us, and we haven't spoken to you since James Kim died in the wilderness, and we send our condolences to the whole CNET family.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Declan McCullough of CNET News. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Lee Burek, Jen Utes, Anna Nagara, and Anuradha Bhagwati. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nagara, and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Special thanks to Megan Whitney, Angela Alston, Uri Galed, Luaya Abu Ospa, John Randolph, Tyshawn Black, Julian O'Connor, Samantha Chamblee. Happy birthday to Anna Nagara. Our website is democracynow.org. There you can sign up for our headlines. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.